from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, students stand up to the Freedom From Religion Foundation and the shocking truth about why students at Parkland High School were gunned down in 2018. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and homeschool dad. Now, you probably heard about or maybe seen a video of the stadium full of students who said the Lord's Prayer prior to a high school football game earlier this month. Well, the Freedom From Religion Foundation had demanded that the traditional student-led prayer prior to the game be replaced with a moment of silence. It was during that moment of silence that a local youth pastor, his youth group, and all of the students that the youth group could get the word to stood and recited the Lord's Prayer. Joining FRC President Tony Perkins to talk about it is Steve Bass, youth pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Opelika, Alabama.
Pastor Bass, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
Well, give us the story. Give us the backstory here. I'm very interested to see how this came about.
So, I mean, I've been in this community, like you said, for 20-something years, and this tradition goes back 100 years. We started playing football in Opelika in 1917, and I spoke to many of the older residents that went to school here, and they said the tradition was going on when they were in high school, that a student would always lead the prayer. It wasn't a teacher, it wasn't a coach or an administration official. It was always a student who would lead a prayer, and the prayer was pretty similar each time. It was, you know, let's have a good time tonight, help the players be free from injury, help our fans be good sports and good hosts to each other. And it was always pretty generic in that way. There was no, you're all you dirty sinners are going to burn if you don't come to Jesus.
Right.
And, it's gone on for a long time. That was something I was very proud of, that I was, because I'm from Central Florida, very different culture. And when I came here, to see that people were still doing this, and I would say, you know, the Christian faith is woven into so much of our culture in Opelika. We pray before city council meetings. We pray at the lighting of the Christmas tree ceremony in downtown. It's just all over what we do, so it was never thought of until last week. Beginning of the week, maybe Monday or Tuesday, we received the letter. Or we were made known. I don't know when the letter was received, but it was put on one of the local news stations, put it on Facebook, that Opelika would now be doing a moment of silence before the national anthem instead of the traditional led prayer from one of the students. And, you know, it was weird. It just got impressed it upon me. And many people have asked, many people have questioned me on this, and I just said, you know, I just felt God speak into my heart that this is not okay, that you need to take a stand. And yeah, many people that in our culture, in our society, talk about how God has been removed from schools and everything else. And it didn't happen overnight. It was a series of concessions like this, where we have tried to be graceful as Christians and make concessions and make decisions to benefit the other side, and before we know it, this is where we are. And so I just didn't feel right. I immediately shared the article on Facebook and just called my students into play, and I said, guys, you don't have to stand for this. They can threaten the coaches' jobs, they can threaten the teachers' jobs, they can threaten the administration. They cannot restrict your rights as students. And so I encourage them to use the Lord's Prayer and to share it with the other students in the student section and in the school, and to not do it in a disrespectful, in-your-face manner, to be reverent and respectful, but to stand up for what they believe in. This is what we preach all the time, is there's going to become a moment where you either have to stand for your faith or you cave in. And it's like in Revelations where Jesus said, I wish you were hot or cold, but don't try to ride the fence. Don't try to sit in the middle. And our students rose up tremendously. The student section is probably about 500 or so students. Stadium seats about 8,000. probably about 6,000 or 7,000 people there for this game, and the students, the parents, the fans, the opposing team found out and joined in as well. It's really awesome.
Well, well done. And I think the instruction is spot on. It should be done respectfully, but we cannot surrender. Because I think this is actually where it has come to. I think it's very appropriate that we're relegated to a moment of silence, which should be prayer. And I think that really symbolizes where, as you said, this systematic surrender of these fundamental rights has left us silent. And it's time to speak up.
Yeah, we've retreated for a long time, and we haven't gone on the offensive because of our culture and society will call us out now, and we're so worried about offending, as you said, you know, one person or a group of people. And, you know, our students were upset, and they really answered the challenge that I put forth and, you know, got their classmates in on it. Some of our students were waiting at the visitor team entrance and telling them what was going on. I remember that the cheerleaders, one of our youth parents, saw the cheerleaders at Chick-fil-A before the game and told them, hey, we want you to know what's going on here tonight. Spread the word among your crowd. And so it was well done. And I had several people call me and say, you know, should we push this? Is this the right thing to do? And I said, you know, I can only speak for myself and what I feel like God has impressed upon my heart, and that is to stand in this moment. And I challenged our students at our worship service on Wednesday night prior to the game. I said, this is one of those pinnacle moments in our history that you get the chance to be a part of. And, even the kids that do not go to this Opelika High School, they go to other schools in the area that are part of our youth ministry. I'm like, take a break, come to our school this week. And many of them did. They came over to our football game just to be a part of this.
So, Steve, let me ask you a final question. Do you think this, because of the students standing up and speaking out, would this cause the administration there to kind of rethink their quick compromise to the Freedom From Religion Foundation?
You know, I hope so. I hope that we'll go back to the drawing board and ask. Many people were asking us today what would be the ramifications if we continued on with what we've been doing. And I was contacted yesterday by someone from the Alliance for Defending Freedoms that wants to provide us legal counsel. And so I hope the Opelika City School System will listen to their counsel and see what they would like to do moving forward. I know maybe last season or two seasons ago at Arkansas State University, the Freedom From Religion group tried to step in there over a situation with a sticker on a helmet that was meant to honor a teammate who had passed away. And the students there didn't, the administration caved, and the students said, no, we're doing this. We're going to continue to do this. I think the sticker had a cross on it with the player's initials or number, and they challenged them. And I just want to, you never know whether or not you're going to win the fight if you don't put up a fight.
And that's absolutely
so
right.
I encourage our administration to at least put our hat in the ring and see what happens. And if it's not, I know this: a movement started Friday night in our football stadium that was probably more powerful than the one student praying over the loudspeaker, because you had an entire football stadium of 6,000 or 7,000 people reciting the Lord's Prayer together and having a moment of church before football, which football in Alabama can be church sometimes. But it was a huge movement, and I'm super proud of our community and our students for the stand that they took this week. And I pray that regardless of what happens, that this will become the new tradition, that we will not just have our 15 seconds of fame, but we'll continue to push and we'll continue to pray together every week, regardless of what happens, so that this can become the new tradition, if nothing else.
Well, Pastor Steve Bass, thank you for being the inspiration and standing up and leading the way, providing that leadership. And that would be my prayer as well, that this not be a one-time thing, but even be, as you described, a movement. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be tracking this very closely. I hope to talk to you again soon in the near future.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Tony. I appreciate you talking about it today.
You can find out more about Steve Bass when you visit TonyPerkins.com. While you're there, look for ways that you can support Family Research Council's efforts to promote religious freedom in the face of sometimes overwhelming odds. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Then come join us at FRC Action's Values Voter Summit in D.C. From October 11th to the 13th, hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Oliver North, Dana Lash, and congressional leaders. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. On Tuesday, Family Research Council hosted a talk with a pair of authors who co-wrote a book about the failures of government with regard to school shootings, specifically the Parkland school shooting in Florida in 2018. With a more detailed introduction, here's FRC President Tony Perkins.
Max Eden and Andrew Pollack are co-authors of the book Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endangered America Students. And I wanted to invite Andrew Pollack to come on the program today. Now, he happens to be the father of Meadow Pollack, who on February 14, 2018, a senior at a high school in Parkland, Florida, was shot along with 16 other students. It was done by a 19-year-old expelled student who had a semi-automatic rifle and went in and killed 17 students. Now, Andrew was here on Tuesday. He shared the tragic story of the murder of his 18-year-old daughter, Meadow. And here's just a portion of what he had to say here on Tuesday.
My son told me there was a shooting at the school. You know, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, you know, it was just maybe it was one incident or something happened with a police officer. It was an accidental misfire. But as the day started regressing, it started getting worse, and the calls kept coming in. And then we couldn't find Meadow all day long. So we went from hospital to my wife worked at the hospital, so we had to look. I had her going from room to room in the hospitals looking for my daughter. We couldn't find her that day. She wasn't in the operating room. We gave up our search. It must have been about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that's when we regrouped at home. And I knew personally when we couldn't reach her by 6 o'clock that my daughter was murdered.
Mr. Pollack, I cannot begin to imagine the depth of your pain as you continue to mourn the death of your daughter. But I want to thank you for sharing this story, boldly sharing this story, so that others might be spared what you have gone through. And thank you for being here at FRC, and thank you for joining me here on Washington Watch today.
Oh, thanks for having me on and, you know, giving me the time to tell my story and to warn parents about what's going on in districts across the country. And, you know, people ask, you know, a lot of people, you know, I never really touch on this. They always, you know, people that are short-sighted, they'll say, well, it was the killer. You know what I mean? He's the only one I should be blaming. Okay, but when you look into it, I really blame that the killer for about 50%. And then the other people that all failed my daughter that in that system. So, you know, because there's multitudes of failures that happen. And the love that I have for my daughter is I'm going to expose them all. And that's what puts me on this quest with this book to get it out and to warn parents and to hold these people accountable one by one for letting this happen to my daughter in that school.
Andrew, what was the first step? I mean, how did you know that this was a much bigger problem than just a shooter going into a school and shooting students? I mean, what was the first clue that showed you that this was just the tip of the iceberg of something that had been created by the policies of that administration?
The first one, it didn't resignate that it was the school district. The first one was the tip that went to the FBI. The woman had called me that called the FBI and said that he was going to be a shooter, that he was going to shoot the school up. And the FBI failed miserably. She had called them, a couple of people called them. And then she started telling me about the shooter. I don't mention by name. She started telling me about the killer, that she warned them, that she even called the sheriff's department and told them that this kid was just a bad, evil kid from the beginning, and he was going to shoot the school up. So that happened pretty quickly within the first week of, you know, my daughter getting murdered. While everyone, you know, was still, you know, the day after the shooting, the superintendent was calling for gun control, Robert Runcie, who brought those policies to Broward County. So from that, then I started getting calls from students that, you know, before the shooting was over, students knew who the killer was. Okay, the school monitors, they call them. You know, that's what they have in liberal schools. They call them monitors. They give them a radio, and they're pretty much useless, you know. The monitors had a meeting about the killer a year prior, saying if anyone was going to shoot the school up, it was going to be this kid.
Andrew, we're up against a break. I'm going to ask you to hold on because I want to finish this on the other side of the break, because you shared some facts Tuesday here when you spoke at FRC that, quite frankly, were absolutely shocking. And people need to know this because this is not out there. This was not told. You're telling the story. It needs to be told. Folks, you need to stick around. You need to hear the rest of what Andrew has to say on the other side of this break. We're coming back with more Washington Watch as we talk with Andrew Pollack, author of a new book, Why Meadow Died. It's about the Parkland shooting and the policies behind it. That's coming up next as we continue our conversation. Don't go away.
Have you subscribed to Tony Perkins' Washington Update yet? This daily email newsletter analyzes the most important events and topics at the forefront of the battles for religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more. Not only in Washington, but around the world. Learn more and subscribe to these must-read stories by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. In fact, you can hear, watch the entire message that Andrew Pollack presented here at the Family Research Council in our speaker series earlier this week. Go to TonyPerkins.com. It's posted right there. Andrew, thank you for sticking around through that break. You were talking about that there were warnings. You know, they talked to the FBI. But you shared a fact, a number, that literally almost caused people to fall out of their seats here. The number of times that the sheriff's office went to Nicholas's house. How many times?
Yeah, 45 times. And the reason why this happens with these policies in place is that the sheriff is an elected official. And he signed on to these policies with the superintendent to reduce crime. Okay, so what they do is they manipulate the statistics to make them like they're doing the greatest. He's the greatest sheriff in the country by reducing crime by 30%. He could say that when he runs for sheriff again in his next term. But what they do is they just stop arresting. Okay, and that's why. When a lot of these Democrat leaders push for background checks, then they push these policies of not arresting.
arrested.
You mentioned Democrats and your dog started barking. Have you taught your dog something?
Yeah, well, he's trained. He's actually, right. People always ask me, why is your dog, what does your dog do? It's a service dog? Well, they hire me to go into companies and he sniffs out Democrats. That's what my dog, that's what my dog could do. But on a serious note, you know, it is, they were brought, these policies were brought, they started with the Obama administration to decrease the school-to-prison pipeline, decrease suspensions and expulsions.
Let me ask you this question. Not to correct the problems, just to quit reporting them.
Correct. And they think, and because the teachers were racist, that's really where it comes from. The teachers didn't have the ability, they didn't trust them to suspend or expel kids equally. Okay? That's where really it starts. And what happens is it creates a whole policy of leniency within the district where teachers just stop having any type of discipline. And these programs that it started in Broward are throughout the whole country. And that's what parents see. I'm the last father that could say I didn't know these things were going on in school. I didn't know that this kid was so dangerous they had to frisk him. Could you believe that? They frisked this kid every day before school. That's how dangerous he was. They didn't let him in with a backpack. But they don't tell the parents or warn us. You know, they never told me. If the teacher has notes, he would say he wants to kill. Did they tell the parents? No. Did they tell the parents they had to walk him around with a security guard from school, from class to class? He was infatuated with shooting, with guns. He would draw stick figures and shoot people, like, with his gun all day long. He'd jump out behind, like, corners of the school in like, a cackle and scare kids. And this is, the teacher had to write these notes for, like, 6 months. She was hostage. So she had to be really particular in her note-taking to just get rid of this kid out of the school. All right? So that was middle school. He goes to a special school, right, where he's supervised. Well, one summer, they're so worried about this kid, how he's acting, they write a note to his psychiatrist that he's dreaming of blood. He talks about killing. There's a hatchet. There was a hatchet missing from his garage. Right, and they were so worried that they wrote to their psychiatrist about changing his medication. But those same counselors that were overseeing him, like 8 months later, recommending mainstreaming him with my daughter into the high school because of these programs. And if parents think it was just in Broward, it's not the case. These emotionally disturbed kids are throughout the whole country. And in order to recognize what you're looking for, you got to see what happened in Parkland. And read my manual and see what they did to my daughter, why Meadow died. Read the book, and it's jaw-dropping, but everything is factual that we took from it. And mainstream media, they didn't want me anywhere in New York or D.C., the only parents that were actually in the country that know the truth about what happened in Parkland had to watch Fox News, because Fox News had me on all week. Tell them the truth of the story of Parkland.
This doesn't fit the left's narrative.
No, it doesn't. It's, you know, they wanted to blame the gun. And I'm not a political guy. If it was the gun, I'd be talking to you, yeah, it was the gun. But after doing my research and these policies in place, it wasn't the gun. It wasn't the NRA. It's these policies that allowed him to be in that school, that allowed for him never to be arrested. He trespassed at the school after he already threatened to shoot the school up at the sheriff's department.
But they didn't arrest him.
Didn't arrest him. So what good is a background check if they don't want to arrest criminals that are dangerous? I'm not saying we don't want all kids. We don't want to hurt kids. Kids that just make a mistake. Sure, right. Let's put them into certain programs that they're mentored by, you know, law enforcement or people. Let's mentor those kids. But some kids that are mentally disturbed, threatening people's lives, punching their mother's teeth out, you know, skinning chickens, they need to be introduced to the judicial system to protect society. Okay, but with these policies, they don't do that.
Amazing. And a point that you made is that this policy coming down from the Obama administration with the school district and with the sheriff's office there was kind of a pilot, but this has been adopted in other school districts across the country, right?
Thousands of schools, Tony. And look, California, people want to question me. Okay, you want to doubt me, my research. Look what happened right now in California, okay, if you're a parent. They just passed a law. It's illegal to suspend disruptive kids in the state of California. So could you imagine being a parent, even if you are a Democrat and have a problem taking in facts, why would you want to subject your kid to an environment where the kids could be disruptive as they want, okay, do it without any consequence? It doesn't make sense to me. And now those policies, okay, that I uncovered in Parkland that got my daughter killed, now is a law in California. And it's throughout the country, and it's their platform.
And parents don't know about it.
They don't know about it because it's what I say to everybody now, parents, you're responsible where you put your child. It's not the politician. It's not the president. It's not your governor. It's not your superintendent. It's you. You decide. Am I going to put my kid in that school? Do I want him going to a charter school, private school, homeschool? You're the decision maker. Don't do what I did and just think that my kid was safe there. Okay, and odds are, Tony, that your kid's not going to get shot like my misfortune. But why put them in an environment where they could sell drugs, where they could get beat up, where they could get bullied, where there's no consequence for a student to speak back to the teacher? And the teacher's got to spend, on average, 10, 12 minutes per lesson dealing with disruptive kids. It's not the right environment, and parents need to speak up. They're the only ones that can make a difference with the public school system.
Well, Andrew, I want to thank you for speaking up. I want to thank you again for your book. Thank you for coming to FRC and lecturing and joining me here today. And we're going to encourage folks to get that book. We're going to promote it and encourage them to share that information with others. So, again, our condolences to you, but our gratitude as well for speaking out. So thanks so much for joining us today, Andrew.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks so much. Have a nice day.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.